The Retirement and IRA Show represents the words and views of the show hosts exclusively and should not be construed as investment, legal, or tax advice. All information is believed to be from reliable sources. However, we make no representation as to its completeness or accuracy. All economic and performance information is historical in nature and is not indicative of any future results. Any indices mentioned on the show are unmanaged and cannot be invested in directly. Diversification and asset allocation strategies do not assure profit or protect against loss. Never make any investment or financial decisions based on information offered on this show without first consulting your financial, legal, or tax advisor. Financial planning services offered through Jim Salnier and Associates, LLC, a registered investment advisor.
This is the Retirement and IRA Show coming to you from beautiful Northern Colorado. Join us as certified financial planner Jim Salnier, as well as Colorado State University finance instructor and certified financial planner Chris Stein, teach you about IRAs, 401ks, annuities, Social Security, pension plans, and estate planning in a fun and enjoyable show. Whether you are listening live in Colorado or streaming from their website or iTunes podcast, Jim and Chris want you to know that they're available to help you plan for your retirement. Just visit their website at jimhelps.com. That's Jim, H-E-L-P-S.com. And click the Meet the Team button on the homepage. Now, here's Jim and Chris with today's show.
Well, hello, everybody, and welcome to the Retirement and IRA Show Q&A edition for this week. Jim let me know. He's got a nice batch of questions all queued up. He's joining me on the recording from his likely future retirement location out in Ohio. But I think we've got the technology all working very smoothly, and we should be able to pull off the podcast without a hitch here. So my understanding is it's a fairly standard Q&A show today. Got a few follow-up questions. People have sent in some questions about a couple previous shows. And as usual, we'll have at least a couple Social Security-based questions right up front here. So, Jim, hope everything's going well for you out in Ohio and you're still liking it as a potential retirement location.
Well, I'm getting to know it, folks. This is the first time I'm officially in my apartment. If it sounds a little echoey, it's because there's nothing in the apartment really right now to absorb the sound. But so far, I've only been here a week. So far, the apartment complex is nice. It's quiet, which is what I wanted. The weather has been outrageously humid, except for today it finally broke. And for the rest of the week, I'll be here for one more week. It's actually supposed to be quite pleasant with dew points only in the 50s, which is quite pleasant weather. Low 80s and dew points in the 50s, I'll take that. But even Chris, I know you would have been crying like a 12-year-old, mm-hmm. but the humidity honestly wasn't that bad. The locals were complaining. I don't know why. I'm not a local, but they were complaining. And I was telling one person, I said, if I was out hiking in this or trying to jog in this, yeah, this is brutal. But just walking, and I even sat outside for lunch in shade, I said it didn't really bother me. In fact, my skin thoroughly enjoyed it.
Yeah.
The moisture was well respected by my skin compared to Colorado.
Yeah, the humidity certainly is much better on your human skin. That is, I will give it that. But there's a large price to be paid that I'm personally unwilling to pay. So it's just me. I understand a lot of people totally fine with it or even like it, but it's not for me. It's bad. And I will admit when I was in Ohio for a week that formed my opinion of my very low opinion of high humidity. I was outdoor all day for all week long. We were outdoors from about 8 in the morning until 4 or 5 in the afternoon. So I was helping a friend of mine who was running a YMCA day camp at the time. So I admit I was outside being somewhat active. But even before we were active, I couldn't walk from his house to the car before sweat was showing up on my shirt. So it's pretty bad in my mind, at least that week.
Yeah, I mean, it is, without a doubt. I know I can say there's some people here that I know, several of them women, actually most of them women, but I do know a lot of men as well. None that I'm dating, it's nothing like that. but we tend to hug hello. And they had been bike riding, and several came up to me to hug me hello after a bike ride. And yeah, it was a little, ooh, do you got a towel that I can borrow? It's a little different on the hugs because
that's called
yeah,
clammy.
Clammy, that's a better way of putting it than sweaty.
Not that's not good.
But the locals seem to just deal with it, and we go from there. But I'll experience both, and this is what they have all shared with me. Summer is not like the first week that I've been here. It's not all 12 weeks of summer is not 12 weeks of that. That they'll have these hot, humid spells, and then a spell coming in where it gets beautiful. So I'm seeing both of that. And even the weather woman on TV, I watch one of the channels, I forget which one. She said the same thing. That, okay, now we're going into our dry spell. And it's going to dry out and be nice in the low 80s with a 50% or 50 dew point. The dew point is what's the killer. When you get above 60, it starts to get bad. It was in the 70s this week. So it can get pretty bad. But anyways, folks, this is my first step in trying to determine if I want to retire here. And the one caution that I give people, because we've seen it in our own practice, I've heard about it anecdotally from other advisors, and I've read about it in the press that I read, industry-driven press, that one of the worst things are clients who move to a location based solely on vacation experience. You go somewhere, you love it, it's beautiful, and I'm running into that here. When people hear, still now, I'm from Colorado, and if they haven't met me yet, they don't know why I want to move. And they just say to me, most people have been to Colorado. And they say, oh, I've been there. It's so beautiful. I would move there in a heartbeat. And I'll ask, what did you do? Where were you? They've always, in summer, Chris, in the mountains, relaxing. Who wouldn't love that?
Right, exactly. Yeah, I get it. They have, they're not trying to garden. They're not shoveling snow. They're not, you know, all the
paying the taxes, stuff. Trying to buy a house, dealing with the traffic,
not trying to buy
the
a
pollution.
House. Yeah, exactly.
So it's I try to explain to them, Colorado is a wonderful vacation experience, but after 26 years of living there, I see more of the side that I don't care for. And that's just the caution I'm trying to give. It's why I'm taking the steps that I'm doing. Now, granted, I've been blessed with the ability to do this. My boss, he and I are pretty close. He's pretty cool. And he says, yeah, sure, you can work remote. And it's allowing me to do this. So I have the financial means, I have the flexibility, and I can come out here and spend some time. But even if you retire and you think you're going to move somewhere under a vacation mindset, I would still encourage you before you buy that permanent home, rent a home for a year or two. Spend some time there, all four seasons. See if you like it, but also get a better feel for where you want to live. And that's what I'm starting to do now. I've been driving around during quote-unquote rush hour, which here is about 4 to 6:30, no matter where you go, similar to Colorado, Chris. It's freaking crowded. And I'm trying to get a better feel for where I can live and access some places without necessarily having to get on 275 or 75 or 71, the major highways north and east and west of Cincinnati. And I'm starting to develop the towns that I might want to consider. I didn't just randomly run out here and buy a house. And I think that was one of the biggest mistakes I made when I moved to Colorado, but I was in my early 30s and I didn't have the flexibility that I have now. Had I the flexibility, I probably would have moved outside of Golden for a variety of reasons that I won't get into, and I wouldn't have moved to where I did. But then I wouldn't have met my best friend ever, Rob Harris, before he sadly passed away. And for that, I'm grateful, not that he passed away, but that I had a good 12 years of life with this man. He was a great, great friend. I wouldn't have met Chris, and I wonder if where he would be and where I would be and where our whole process would be. So a lot of good came from it, but I blindly moved on vacation time. I had come out here for a few weeks on vacation over the last few years, before moving, the last few years before moving. And I just fell in love with it, and I just wanted to have a house, and I moved. But I didn't do any forethought. And I'm going to encourage you to do that forethought planning before you just move on a vacation mindset. If you've been living somewhere like my parents, excuse me, my mom and sister live in Florida. They've been there for years. Before that, they were in a condo. So when they bought, they pretty much knew where they were going to be. If you're already doing that, don't worry about it. But if you're just thinking, I'm going to retire and move to this place or that place because we vacation there and it's gorgeous, I would encourage you to be a little more pragmatic and perhaps rent for a year or two before just jumping in with both feet.
Which, and I'm all for that as well. It just seems awkward for people that may not have rented for 40 or 50 years since they were in their 20s, maybe, and they've owned a house ever since. And becoming a renter again just seems like going backwards, but it isn't. It is a pragmatic way of testing it out, making sure living there all year round is really where you want to be. And people probably don't know the activities they want to do and where they're located. And they might realize they're on the wrong side of town. They're, you know, they want to be there wherever it is, but just they want to be 2 miles east or west or something, or they don't want to be in this particular neighborhood, or they want to be closer to where they shop or the places they like to go eat or walk to, or, you know, whatever the reason is. And that renting gives you that flexibility to discover all of that before you're committed to a house, which, you know, technically you could sell, but oh my gosh, going through that is much worse than ending your lease and moving to another place, your permanent place at that point, if you've discovered it. So I'm all for what Jim is describing and kind of the way he's going about looking at it and investigating it.
Right. Thank you. So anyways, I'll share more over the coming years. I'm here for 3 years. I said mentally that I would give Ohio 3 years of back and forth with Airbnbs and living out of suitcases, which I did. And if I liked it, I would do 3 more years of living out of an apartment and spending more and more time here. So just a cute little aside on cost of living of Ohio compared to Colorado, Chris. It'll make you scratch your head. So I went to register my truck, which turned out to be a whole cluster. I won't bore the hell out of people with it, but the DMV or BMV, they call it out here, Bureau of Motor Vehicles instead of Department of Motor Vehicles, was very helpful, even though I had to run around to several different places because they claim they mailed my title, but I never got it. So they were blaming the post office, and of course I can't find, they don't put a tracking on it. So I had to cancel that title, go to another place, get a new title, so on and so forth. When it came down to actually paying the fee, and I'm finally got it all set, and I'm with the woman at the little gate thing there. And she says, how many years would you like to register it for? I said, how many years? In Colorado and Massachusetts, where I originally came, it's 1 year.
Right.
She says, yeah, pick a number between 1 and 5. I said, is this a card trick? She said, no, you can register for 1 year. You can register for 5 years. How many years do you want to register it? So I said to her, I says, you know, because when we were waiting for things, I was sharing with her she was wondering why I was doing. She says, you're in Colorado. What are you doing? So she knew the whole story. I said, well, I said to myself, I'd give the apartment 3 years. She said, perfect. Let's register the vehicle for 3 years. It expires on chocolate cake with white frosting day in 2028. Perfect.
Yeah.
So it gives me 3 years to make up my mind. Mm-hmm. Now, this is what will freak you out. In Colorado, folks, we pay annual excise taxes on our vehicles. And pretty much for the first 7 years of a vehicle, you're going to pay thousands and then down to the high hundreds to register it. I paid $217 to register my car for 3 years. Brand new, mighty, massive, macho, manly Maverick. 217. It was either 217 or 237, I forget.
And that's a good eye-opener for people, but and I'm going to remind them not to look at that as, oh, gee, all taxes and all expenses in there are going to be the same.
I agree.
Because when you look around the country, and we've dealt with customers or clients all over the country for years now, I've been fascinated to see the variations in things like that. where you got to look at the whole story, and there's all kinds of places where they tax you, right? Your state and local government has to function, and they have to have revenue, and it's going to come via taxes. It's just a matter of different places have decided to do it different ways. There are certainly some level differences, right? There's places that overall are relatively high taxes versus low. But when you look at, for instance, states all the time that have no income tax, you look at their other taxes and it's like, well, no wonder they don't have state income taxes, because they're raking you over the coals for property taxes and vehicle registrations and gas taxes and sales taxes and all this other stuff that they've got. So you got to, I am impressed by that, I will admit, because the first year here on that new truck would probably have been about $800 just for 1 year, maybe more. It's a graduated scale. It goes down after the first couple of years it's been registered here in Colorado. But a brand new vehicle like that,
it would have been north of $1,000. It would have been north of $1,000.
Might have been north of $1,000 that first year. So for $217 for the full 3 years. That's a very enviable number. I will very much agree with that. But
and you get to pick a number between 1 and 5.
Yeah, that's also talk about convenient. Yeah. Interesting.
All righty. Anyways, I digress, but yeah. We'll share more with you in an effort to try to help those listeners who are also contemplating a relocation in retirement. And maybe you can learn from my experiences. All right. So we're going to begin with some Social Security questions. Then we have a new question of the week, which actually is a Social Security question and an annuity question. And we're going to get into a question that seems to always rear its head. Another one of those, Chris, but okay. We'll get in. Yeah, you already know what it'll be.
Yeah.
And we'll get into that as well.
Okay.
All right. Sounds good. We have a Social Security PSA or a question. Two questions. Which one do you want first?
Let's do the PSA first.
The PSA first. All righty. Okay. I can't find the PSA. There it is. Okay. So this is kind of an interesting one. He does give a hint. So a PSA with a hint, that's unique. Mm-hmm. So he says, here's my state quiz for Chris. The state that I live in has a city known as the Steel City, which is the location of the first commercial radio station in the United States. Oh, you should, you're going to get, if you don't get this.
I'll get that because I've been there. They could have stopped at Steel City. I know that's Pittsburgh. So it's got to be in Pennsylvania. I did not know that was the location of the very first commercial radio station. The very first radio station of any kind, I believe, broadcast from the Empire State Building, if I recall, or something like that. But it wasn't, I don't think it was commercial at that time. That's probably the distinction. But yeah, Steel City's Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania.
I didn't realize the Empire State Building. Was that before or after the giant gorilla climbed it and got shot down by biplanes?
Had to be before, because I think the gorilla tore it off, tore the antenna off.
Oh, is that what he tore off at the top when he climbed up it there in the movie?
I think so.
Ah, okay. Interesting.
So
see that? We learned something new.
Yeah.
All right. He says, I'm following up to your question about the six-month rule for Medicare Part A enrollment when you reach out and contact Social Security. I don't think that you made it clear that the forced enrollment is only for Medicare Part A, which is the no premium cost hospital insurance plan. Part A does not cover any other medical expenses, unless they will be covered in retirement by another health insurance plan. The listeners will need to call Medicare to enroll in Part B or C and D. And then he went on to share a little bit about his Medicare plan, but I'll skip that. I kind of wanted to get to that, Chris, because first of all, you can opine. He's referencing things that you were saying.
Yep.
But you and I also made mention on this forced backdating enrollment that you are theoretically covered. So if you had health issues or out-of-pocket expenses, we were asking, Has anyone had that happen and they try to apply for a refund or go to the hospital and say, hey,
Have
don't
them
bill
rebill
me,
it.
Rebill it to Medicare. But it did get me to thinking, he is right. If this is only Part A that someone was forced enrolled into and they didn't enroll in B or get a Medigap policy or anything of that nature, it's going to be very limited on what Medicare would cover anyways on that backdating enrollment.
Correct. However,
if
you had medical issues, you would ask them to enroll you in Part B as well, and they'd apply the same backdating to that. So he is correct that the forced enrollment is Part A. And where that comes in usually with conversations that we've had on the show here is people enrolling in Social Security. They don't realize that by law, you cannot collect Social Security without being enrolled in Part A if you're eligible for it. So that, and I think it was, and I've kind of guessed that the reason for that is back in the day, they thought, well, if you qualify for it and it's free, why would someone turn it down? We're going to force people. We'll just make sure it gets forcibly turned on for people. There might be another reason for it, but it's tied to collection of Social Security. Where that comes into play is if you're enrolled in any type of Medicare, even just Part A, which is free, and you didn't opt in for Part B and Part D or any other elements of Medicare, you are not that in the months that you're enrolled in Medicare, you are ineligible to be contributing to an HSA. So for those wanting to contribute the maximum and they're trying to take it up to the very last month. And I do want to clarify, it's not technically you can't make a contribution after that. It's that the amount of contribution you're allowed to make in a year is pro rata based on how many months of the year you're eligible. So you can continue to make the contribution up until April 15th of the year following the year that you were eligible to make the contribution. But they're going to calculate pro rata the number of months you weren't on Medicare and the number of months you are on Medicare in a given year to determine how much you're allowed to contribute. So this surprises some people who have waited until after 65 to enroll in Medicare. They do something as innocent as maybe turning on their Social Security because maybe they're at their full retirement age. So they realize they can collect now without worrying about the earnings test. So they turn on their Social Security, not realizing that's going to automatically turn on Part A. Not only is it going to do that, it's going to backdate 6 months from their application date. For technically from the date you contact them, 6 months prior to that. So it isn't all about Part B and D. And if you want those, listener is absolutely right. You have to proactively enroll in those. Those are not automatically turned on. Now, when you file for Social Security and you're over 65, they usually ask you, hey, do you want to, while you're at it, do you want to turn on your Part B? A is the only one that's just automatically forced upon you without you doing anything, and you can't turn it down. You can't even say, oh, no, I don't want it because I want to keep making HSA contributions. That is not an option under current law. They could change it. Give people that flexibility to continue who are maybe still working and have an employer plan that qualifies to not, have you enrolled in Part B. Under current rules, if you're collecting Social Security and you're over the age of 65, you're getting Part A. There's no turning it down, and that has impact on your HSA contribution eligibility. So I'm glad they pointed this out because we were kind of talking about it just generically as Medicare, but the true forcibly, what's forced upon you is the Part A only.
Okay, this next one has no hint. Nope. Let me see. Oh, no, there is a hint. Oh, he buried it in there. Hi, Chris and staff. I'm from the state.
Are you now just part of the staff?
Oh, damn, I didn't even see that. Yeah. Hey, that's a dig against me.
It's okay.
Hi, Chris. And I'm staff. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
Hi, Chris and staff. I should have deleted this email instead of reading. Hi, Chris and staff. I'm from the state that, well, remember the day that somebody called you the other guy? That one was funny.
Oh, you really like that one? Well, here's your payback. You're part of the staff.
I'd rather be staff than the other guy. All right. Hi, Chris and staff. I'm from the state that Napoleon Bonaparte's brother, named Joe, had a home that he lived in for 20 years.
Now, first of
when
all,
when I originally read this email,
Napoleon
I thought,
really have a brother named Joe? Let's get past that first. Is that true?
That was what I was thinking. So you have this very regal name, Napoleon Bonaparte, and Joe. Tell me Joe didn't grow up with a complex.
Huh. Anyway, well, that's not the question. What state was his brother?
Well, we need to figure out if Napoleon really had a brother named Joe.
Well, I'm going to look it up after you. I have no idea.
When your parents sit around, let's call this one Napoleon.
Yeah.
We'll call him Joe.
It was probably Joseph or something, he was just being funny, calling him Joe. But I'll look it up while you're talking in a few minutes.
Anyway, what state did Napoleon's brother, allegedly named Joe, live in for 20 years? I never knew.
I have no idea, but guessing I'll go with Massachusetts. Seems like a place Joe would go.
You're on the East Coast. That's close. According to this gentleman, New Jersey. New Jersey. Now we have to figure out if Napoleon really had a brother named Joe.
Okay. Well, I'll find an opportunity shortly to look it up, and I'll let everybody know.
All right. Well, this is a Social Security question. Don't look it up now. You have to pay attention.
Yeah, I know. All right.
I was lucky enough to collect on my wife's Social Security. She collected at 62 and waited to 70. Her date of birth is April 6th. My date of birth is September 11th. Mm-hmm. But I receive my Social Security not on the third Wednesday of the month, but on the second Wednesday of the month. Mm-hmm. That has always been the date when I collect on her account and stayed the same when I switched to my own account. Mm. I was just wondering, is this how it works for everyone? So interesting, they didn't change his Wednesday, if you will. They kept him on the wife's Wednesday. Mm-hmm.
We haven't talked about this a whole lot, so I'm glad this question came in. I always like when it's something kind of new. First of all, what he's describing is not allowed anymore. He's describing back when you could file a restricted application for just a spousal benefit and then let your own continue to grow to 70 and then switch to your own. That is no longer allowed. That was grandfathered in, that rule, for people who were born before January 2nd of 1954. Since all of those people now are over the age of 70, the people who could have benefited from that strategy are, you know, it wouldn't benefit them now because they're all over 70 and everyone else is disallowed from doing that. So what he's describing, he did in the past. You're not allowed to do that. However, the rule is, first I'll remind everybody of the payment date rule, which is depending on the day of month you're born, that determines which Wednesday you receive your Social Security retirement benefit. If you're born on the 1st through the 10th, you receive it on the 2nd Wednesday of each month, the 11th through the 20th on the 3rd Wednesday of each month, and if you're born after the 20th of the month, you get the 4th Wednesday of each month. That first week of the month is reserved for SSI and other special payments. So it's the 2nd, 3rd, and 4th Wednesday where standard retirement benefits go out. However, if you're collecting on someone else's record, so he said he collected a spousal benefit, the same would be true of a survivor benefit, you are paid based on the day of birth of the person's record upon which you are claiming. So that's why he initially started by them paying him on his wife's payment date. Even though he should have been paid on the third Wednesday, he started out receiving it on the second when his wife did because of her date, which was April 6th was her birth date. So she clearly falls in that first group. What I have never gotten specific confirmation of or found, but I've heard from a number of people, so I believe it to be true, and this is another instance, that once they start you on a certain payment date, it stays the same. So when he switched to his own, they didn't push him back a week then. That's just, you know, once they set your payment date, what cohort or group you're in, it seems to be sticky and you stay in that payment date. I've seen it also happen for people who started off with some other benefits and they were receiving them in the first week of the month. And then they started receiving a retirement benefit and they continued to get those benefits on the first week of the month. So all I can surmise from that is that in the formal rules and policies of Social Security, that once your payment date is established for benefits, it remains with you, I believe, indefinitely. But that explains why he started off on his wife's and then it stayed based on timing. It's based on the person's record upon which you are claiming. So he wasn't claiming on his own record. He was claiming on his spouse's record initially. So he got a week earlier payment. So kudos to him. If it was later, though, he would have been penalized. He would have been, you know, if hers was in the last third of the month, he would have been stuck with those payments instead. So it is what it is. So an interesting
little known fact.
Yeah, little twist there.
A little twist on Social Security, absolutely. Mm-hmm. All right, yeah. Very good. Okay, final Social Security question before we get to annuity questions and other questions. Mm-hmm. All right, where is the final Social Security question? Here it is. See if there is a question. No. This came in from our blog post, helpwithmysocialsecurity.com. And a lot of the people who come to that blog post don't even know we have a podcast, let alone ask people to give trivia questions to try to stump you. So this was very short. Reminds me of me. Short, and I guess to the point. They are from the state of Michigan. She writes, it's a female. I will be officially married for 11 years, October 15th of 2025. I am claiming Social Security disability, and I'm wondering what spousal benefits I will be eligible for after divorce. So I don't know if they're in the process of getting a divorce, Chris, or she is just contemplating getting a divorce, and she wants to know before she takes that step what I guess her Social Security rights or privileges would be with her officially being married 11 years on October 15th. So she's already past 10, which is the big one.
Right.
So 11 is great, but 10 was the key.
Yeah, and that's the key, Jim, as you mentioned, the 10 years. Once you've been married for 10 years and they measure it right to your anniversary day, so you've got to be fully 10 years in the marriage. Once that's happened, if the marriage ends in divorce, you still basically retain the rights of a spouse for purposes of claiming Social Security. So any benefits that you would otherwise be eligible for, if you were still married, you still are eligible to receive being divorced once you've been married for at least 10 years to that person. So that's true unless you get remarried, then spousal benefits would stop and would attach to the new spouse. Or if you're collecting survivor benefits, if your ex died, for instance, you could still collect those on the dead ex-spouse's record as long as you waited to remarry until after age 60. But if you don't remarry, so let's, you know, to keep it simple, leaving that off, the fact that you've been married over 10 years already, you don't need to make it till October of this year, you could divorce now and retain any eligibility for spousal benefits. Now, if you're already on Social Security disability, likely that's going to be better than spousal benefits might be for you. But who knows? We don't have any of the numbers. So I can't tell you whether you'd want to immediately try to do something, whether you're even eligible, because I don't know your ages. So there's a lot of those normal qualifiers, though. But think of it as this. As long as you know the basic rules for collecting a spousal benefit, you will still play by those rules after you're divorced. You actually have a little more flexibility, I'll mention, which is if you're divorced, the one thing that if you're married has to be true to collect a spousal benefit is that your spouse has to have claimed the benefit of their own to unlock the door. As long as you've been divorced at least 2 years, they don't enforce that rule so that your ex-spouse can't hold your spousal benefit hostage by refusing to claim. So there is that actually, you know, you get everything as if you were still married, plus a little extra flexibility.
Chris, I'm in that. Certainly not questioning your expertise mm-hmm. on Social Security, mm-hmm. but there's a 2-year hurdle before mm-hmm. they could file?
Yes. For the following reason, let's say, just to throw some ages out here, your spouse has to, her spouse, we'll talk about her spouse, who's about to be an ex-spouse, for her to qualify, if they were still married, he would have to be 62 and have filed because he has to unlock the door. Now, if they're divorced, he still has to be 62, but he doesn't have to have filed. However, if they've been divorced within 2 years, they don't give her that get out of jail free card. There has to be 2 years, and they put this rule in to close what could be considered a loophole that married couple, your husband reaches 62 in their example, he would have to file for you to collect. And you heard from someone else, if you were divorced, you wouldn't have to wait for him to file to collect. So let's get it divorced and we'll just still live together and be happy as a couple, but we'll be divorced so we can file immediately without you filing. They put that 2-year hurdle in there to prevent that loophole is why that's in there. But if your ex has filed, then there's no 2 years because you've met all the normal requirements for receiving a spousal benefit. So they don't penalize you. But if you want that extra benefit, you have to have been married at least or divorced at least 2 years before.
Yeah, I understand why they mm-hmm. do it, but it seems mm-hmm. to fly in the face of what you were saying. Gee, they don't want a spouse to be penalized by the other spouse mm-hmm. being able to say, hey, I'm not going to file Social Security, so you can't claim anything. So they say, oh, you can file even though the other spouse hasn't. But then they say, well, not for 2 years. So yeah. You could get screwed over.
There is a little penalty, I guess. There is a little penalty there, yes. But they minimize it by just making it 2 years. But there is that little hurdle that if your ex has not filed, which is normally required for you to file a spousal benefit if you were married. If they have not filed, if you've been divorced more than two, that doesn't matter. You can still file for a spousal benefit. But if it's been less than 2 years, you're going to have to wait either till the 2-year period is over or your ex files for benefits. At that point, it immediately unlocks the door for you. So yeah, there's this little speed bump there. Intended to close a loophole of people getting divorced just to play this game. But for people legitimately, it could be seen as a little bit of a penalty, a little pain, where you got to wait a little longer than you otherwise would want to because your ex hasn't filed and you haven't reached that 2-year mark yet.
Okay, fair enough. Learn something new every day. Mm-hmm. Perfect. All righty, folks. Well, that takes care of our Social Security questions. One PSA, two questions. Mm-hmm. We are going to do an annuity question. Before we get to the annuity question, we're going to get to, is this technically a new question? It is technically a new question of the week, although I think one of the Social Security questions came in this week too, but I could be wrong. We might have inadvertently done two new questions of the week. This new question of the week is on a topic we haven't discussed, I think, Chris, ever on the show.
Interesting.
Correct me if I'm wrong. Did we ever talk about 5-year rules on Roth IRAs before? I can't remember. Do you?
You're hilarious.
Have we spoken about this topic? I can't remember.
Not in at least 48 hours.
Okay.
It's okay, though. But this one, I will, you know, as much as we, you know, make fun of constantly getting these questions, it is the fault of Congress making these rules, as somewhat convoluted as they are. Obviously, if they didn't intend them to be convoluted, and although a few people, when they fully learn the rules, don't find them to be necessarily convoluted, the fact that so many people are confused about this is the feedback to Congress that they should be realizing, oh my God, 90% of the population is confused by all of this. Let's make it simpler. That hasn't happened yet. So it's Congress's fault, and we're just joking around. We realize why you're all sending in these questions regularly, because it's confusing as all get out. And we'll continue to answer them, because that's our public service to you all, trying to clarify this congressional confusion.
Well, this one has a twist. I would say the five-year rule is just a supporting actor. The main actor is the rule of 55. So he begins first with his hint. I live in the state that boasts the world's, and he capitalized world, the world's longest cave system, with over 400 miles of mapped passageways, not even counting the unmapped passageways, I guess, in one cave system.
I've heard this before. I want to say Arkansas.
Okay. Are you going to? You said you want to say it. Are you going to say it? You're going to say something else?
I think I'm going to say Arkansas still.
You're going to say Arkansas?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, you should have went a little further north and to the left. Excuse me, right.
Well, are we playing a geography game now?
A little bit south of me. Probably from where I am, maybe 22 miles south of me.
Kentucky?
Not the cave, but the state.
Kentucky?
Kentucky.
You're kidding.
Kentucky is home to the world's longest cave system, called Mammoth Cave.
Huh. Interesting. Okay. Learn something new every day on the show.
There you go.
Mine for the day.
People have told me I have to go to Mammoth Cave and do some of the hiking in there.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's just, again, 400 known mapped miles of trail. Some you don't even have to bend over and do anything crazy on. You just go walking in a cave.
Yeah.
Okay.
And we learned two things today, because Napoleon did have a brother, Joseph,
who settled
in Bordentown, New Jersey. Point.
Did he have anything else with his name? Like, I don't know, Joseph.
Giuseppe di Bonaparte was his.
That's a little better than Joe.
Mm-hmm. But Giuseppe becomes Joseph in English, apparently.
Hence Joe.
Yeah. And then shortened to Joe.
All right. Well, Napoleon definitely stole all the thunder in that family.
Yeah. And Joe was the older. Joe was older. It was his younger brother causing all that trouble. Yeah.
Yeah. Probably shaking his head over his younger brother. Okay. I'm 49 with plans to potentially retire at 55 from a company where I have my entire 401k balance.
Mm-hmm.
At that time, the mix of pre-tax versus Roth 401k will be about 80-20. So I guess he'll have about 80% of his money in a traditional 401k, folks.
Yep.
20% of his money in a Roth 401k.
Yep.
Yes, my Roth is 5 years old. So he's getting that right out of the way, Chris.
Mm-hmm.
Five-year-old Roth.
It's for Roth 401k. It's 5 years old.
Roth 401k, yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I most likely will use the rule of 55 to begin withdrawing from my 401k, which will keep me from owing penalties. Why don't you explain what he's talking about there for those who may not quite know?
Yeah, so typically, most people know at this point that there's a magic age of 59 and a half where you then avoid a 10% penalty. It's one of the reasons you can avoid a 10% penalty tax on distributions from retirement accounts that's assessed prior to 59 and a half. There's then a second rule that says, for those of you who retire in the year you turn 55 or later, distributions from the retirement account at that company can avoid the 10% penalty. Other retirement accounts you may have, including individual accounts like IRAs, don't get that special exception at 55. But at 55, as long as you're taking money out of your company account from which you retired and you separated from service in the year you turn 55 or later, they waive that 10% penalty on those distributions from that company retirement account.
Was that my cue?
That's your cue.
Perfect. Thanks for that summary. Mm-hmm. Okay. I will mostly use the rule of 55 to save on the penalty. Mm-hmm. Of course, I will be taxed at regular income along with a pension, my dividends, and interest I'm receiving. Mm-hmm. But what if we need to withdraw from the Roth 401k prior to me turning 59 and a half? How does the rule of 55 work then? It seems from research I've done, I can avoid the early withdrawal penalty by applying the rule of 55. I'm trying to see, applying the rule of 55 if I withdraw before 59 and a half, but I would still have to pay tax on my earnings. Is this right? And if this is right, I definitely won't pull from the Roth 401k until 59 and a half. But I'd like to get confirmation that I will actually have to pay taxes on the earnings. So again, why I said this kind of has to do with the five-year rule is he pointed out that his Roth is 5 years. He's looking to take, Chris, a qualified distribution.
Mm-hmm. And so this has a little twist we haven't talked about before.
Right.
Yep.
So a qualified distribution listener, this gentleman made it a point. My Roth is 5 years old.
Yep.
Why did he make that point, listener? Or listeners, and not just one person listening. Because what is known as a qualified withdrawal, he wants to take his earnings out of the Roth tax-free. That's why we have Roths. You put after-tax dollars in. You want them to grow and hopefully grow a lot, and then you want to spend it. And when you withdraw it, you don't want to have to pay taxes on it. That's called a qualified withdrawal. I've said repeatedly that a qualified withdrawal has two prongs. It's like a two-prong pitchfork. It's got two prongs, and you need to satisfy both prongs. First prong, your Roth is 5 years old. He took care of that. He kind of wants to ignore the second prong. Right. He's wondering, if I follow the rule of 55, can I ignore the second prong? No.
No.
The second prong says one of these four things must be happening in order to take money out tax-free on the growth.
Yeah.
Your money that you put in, contributions, can come out at any time for any reason, no taxes, no penalties. I think everybody knows that. It's the earnings. First prong, he hit it with the five-year rule. That's why I said this is kind of a five-year rule. Second prong, you have to be 59 and a half or older, which he's not, dead, which he's not, but he could be in a few years when he turns 55, then his beneficiaries will benefit. Disabled, which he's not, and hopefully he won't be, or buying a first-time home when you are allowed to take $10,000 of interest out tax-free. If none of those four are satisfied, and they won't be, the very rule of 55 is to avoid the 10% early withdrawal penalty,
right,
which he rightly pointed out he would avoid when taking money out of his traditional 401k. He'll save that 10% early withdrawal penalty, but there's no get out of jail free card after age 55 where that second prong of the two-prong test for a qualified distribution from a Roth just goes away magically.
Right.
So he would still have to pay taxes on the earnings.
Yep. Now, for most people, it's a moot point for the following reason, is that by ordering rules, the first dollars to leave the Roth 401k...
No, don't go down that road.
Oh, because it's a 401k.
401k.
Yeah. If it was an IRA, different ordering rules, but you're right on the 401k. Well, I'm glad you stopped me because I probably would.
Yeah, but Google real quick, that we ever rely on Google, folks. I don't think that went away under Secure 2 or the A.
Yeah.
But we got to, how do you pronounce the A? Big beautiful.
Because it's one big beautiful bill.
One big beautiful bill act.
Yeah.
I don't think the Obama or Secure 2 got rid of that, but Google it real quick. Did the pro rata rule on Roth distributions or whatever, however you want to word it, go away?
Okay. Okay. The quick answer was there's no mention of the Roth 401k pro rata rule in the One Big Beautiful Act. So I think we can safely assume that that did not change. So there is that little fly in the ointment. Now, one thing could he not, though, not to go on too much of a tangent, roll the Roth portion of his 401k out to an IRA and then play by the Roth IRA distribution rules?
Are you talking to me because I wasn't paying attention?
Yes.
I was just...
No, I'm saying.
I was trying to get a coffee and be very quiet about it. Very sneaky. And I got back to the table and I thought, ooh, I made it.
Whenever you're doing that, the way just people can hear how the sausage is made now, mute your microphone. Because I always look up to see if your microphone is muted.
That's a good idea.
If it's muted, I proactively give you more keywords to see if you're ready to answer something. And then if I see you unmute, I know I can safely stop talking. So I assumed you were sitting there waiting to speak because your microphone wasn't muted.
So, well, I was sitting here, but I had just literally put my headphones back on. Problem. And I was like, I think you said something I was supposed to.
Yeah, no problem. So no mention of changes. So we can assume that the rule is still the same. Pro rata distribution of earnings and basis, if you will, from Roth 401ks, which is different. Could he not, though, roll his Roth 401k out into a Roth IRA and then play by the IRA distribution ordering rules?
But then he wouldn't have, because he's still going to be younger than...
It doesn't matter. He's just...
59 and a half.
He could then just get his contributions only out.
Oh, yes. He can do that. Absolutely. Yeah.
So where I was going before you headed me off and reminded me of the pro rata application here, that normally if it's a Roth IRA, it's a moot point because you're not going to get to the earnings until you've distributed all of your contributions, all of your conversions, if there were any. Then you would get to earnings, which need to be a qualified distribution to be tax-free. So between 55 and 59 and a half, not too many people are going to eat through all of their contributions necessarily. Some people might, and I don't know what is, you know, how long he's been contributing to the Roth, and, you know, maybe it was mostly a long time ago, so it's mostly earnings. That's always possible too, so I don't know. But he could, if he really wants to manipulate things and have access to just his contributions tax-free before 59 and a half, he could, and then not have to worry about earnings being forced upon him pro rata, he could roll out to a Roth IRA. And
he could, because he made it sound, Chris, like he's not planning on taking money out of
but
the
might
Roth 401k.
Need to. Yeah.
But maybe in any year, he might be pushing... Yeah. Another bracket, or he might, I don't know. He just, for some reason or another, might want Roth money. Right. You make a good point. If he has enough contributions and the employer will let him isolate the Roth 401k and just move that, then yes, if he moved it to a Roth IRA, the ordering rules would magically reappear.
Yeah, and rolling out just the Roth is important for him because he wouldn't want to roll out the traditional because then he loses the rule of 55 exemption, which he clearly wants to take advantage of. So he definitely need to have an employer that allowed the Roth to go out and not force you to also take the traditional side with it.
Correct. And the reason he wouldn't have to pay a 10% penalty or taxes, folks, is he would just be withdrawing his basis from the Roth IRA.
Right.
But I definitely would encourage him, if he is going to do that, to first confirm with his employer that they'll allow him to do that. And even though I'm 99.9999% certain what Chris and I just described can happen, I would double check with whoever your advisor or tax expert is, or Google Chat, whatever GPT, whatever you use to proof, just to make sure. We can't stress that enough, folks. Chris and I, we're not perfect. And we may joke around a lot, but we certainly are not perfect. And we are human and we can make mistakes. I don't believe anything we said on this particular question is wrong, but I'm not going to give it the 100% guaranteed seal of approval. Just that little caveat we want to throw out there.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, totally.
All right, let's get to this one because two people made some good points. And I want to go through this. Chris knows this question because I had to have him get me some data numbers. We wanted to proof our numbers, if you will. And he knows how to use this, even though I know annuities, he knows. How did you end up being the keeper of the software? I don't know. But
Because as part of the retirement planning process, I need to be able to estimate how much it's going to cost someone to acquire more secure income to cover their minimum dignity floor. And in the early days, I would always have to kind of pause and then run it by you or Andrew or someone to pull me a SPIA quote. And
gotcha.
then I got to the point where I was doing it multiple times a week, and it just made more sense for me to just do it directly. So I just figured out how to do it and have done it ever since. So that's kind of how
And it's
I,
been so long since I've
yeah,
done it, Chris,
right.
I wouldn't even know how to log in and do it.
Yeah, it's all good.
Okay. But I wanted to get this has to do, and I don't have my HP 12C with me. I'm gonna have to order one. So we're gonna have to rely on you still using that Texas Instrument thing, or you gone to a HP yet?
I go back and forth. I can use pretty much any of them, but I
All right,
tend
cool.
to use, I end up with a lot of the TIs because that's the calculator that most of the students at the university use. And at the end of every year, there's usually one or two that end up being abandoned for some reason, left behind. So I end up amassing them. So I've got them in every bag, on every desk, in every drawer around. So they just are convenient. So I usually am grabbing a TI.
You should give them to other kids who can't
I
afford one.
do. I mean, if
Okay.
I hear anybody who, can't, they're relatively inexpensive. They're under $30, but still, there it all adds up. That's another
Oh
reason
my
why.
God, my first HP 12C, Chris, I can't even remember what it was, but it was hundreds. I mean, this is going back
Right.
to the 90s
Yeah.
when it was top of the line tech.
Yeah. So
Wow.
they're under $30, but still, I'm really sensitive to that. Whenever possible, I try to use textbooks that are inexpensive as well. So, these were, left behind by other students. So I always pay it forward if I find someone who needs it because of financial need.
Okay. Well, this gentleman sent a very good email that we could theoretically do an entire show on, but we won't. And then there was another person who wrote, and I can't find his email. So I'll have to paraphrase. I'm still searching for it. But he, in essence, remember a couple of weeks ago now, I think is when we did the show. Yeah, because I didn't do the last Q&A show, right? It was you and the two J's.
Yeah, it was a couple
And we
weeks ago.
talked about. No, it was you did the Q&A show. When we last did the EDU show prior to Matt coming on, that show before Matt, we talked about living benefits, and I mentioned a particular fixed indexed annuity that I was helping someone with.
Right. It was their brother or
And
sister was thinking about it, and they were wanting some input.
correct, even
Yeah.
though the fee was going to be about $341,000 over a 10-year period, they would pay out of the million that they were willing to put into this annuity. I showed them that they would pay $341,000, and I said the fee is essentially a red herring because they are buying this. They made it perfectly clear they want the income. But this was a different type of annuity. It was a withdrawal benefit annuity. And I was brought into the mix to lend some advice to a client of ours. The client of ours wasn't buying this, but someone related to them was. And he was a little confused. And I went on to explain that this annuity from a highly rated insurance company, I will give them that. But most of these withdrawal benefit annuities, and I don't say this in a necessarily negative way, so long as you understand all the nuances, but they're really designed to be very similar to a fishing lure. That's the best analogy that I can come up with. Not because I love fishing, but because that's essentially what they're designed to do. You look at a fishing lure, it's going to be shiny. It'll have spinners. It'll have beads. It may have tails on them. It may have the baffle at the front that breaks the water. You can have a lure that has all of that and more. All in a way to catch the attention of a fish and getting that fish to do what, Chris?
To bite.
So to bite.
To get hooked, yep.
So that's what they try to do. It's pretty hard. You just think of a SPIA, single premium immediate annuity, as a worm. That's it. It's a hook and a worm. It's simple, straightforward. It'll work.
Yep.
The annuity here, the fixed index annuity with a living benefit rider, guaranteed minimum withdrawal benefit rider, the attempt to take a verb, the worm on a hook, the verb annuity, a single premium immediate annuity or a deferred income annuity, to take a verb and keep it a noun, which is our verbiage of just an annuity. It's just no income benefit, so to speak, no loss of access to your principal, put it that way.
Yeah.
Outside of the penalty phase, there's no, it's still your money. You still have an account statement that'll show you your balance every year, gross of the penalty, net of the penalty, and after the penalty phase is over, it's all yours. So you still have access to the money. That's what we call the noun, but it has the ability to pay you a stream of income. Okay. Those types of annuities, those are the fishing lures because they're so complex and they're so front-loaded with all these bells and whistles. So that's what I mean by the fish. If you're a fisherman, you know what I'm saying. If you're not a fisherman, you might have an idea of what I'm saying. But some lures, folks, oh my God, they'll have four, five, six different things on them. And others are fairly simple and straightforward. Okay. But I did say, I concede on the podcast that to me, the $341,000 was a red herring and it didn't concern me. And I passed that on to this person. I wanted to point out to them what the fee was, but when they repeatedly shared with me, I want the income, I want the income, I want the income, they weren't looking at the $1 million anymore as an asset. They were looking at it as income.
So they were choosing to look at it that way. When you buy a annuitized annuity, like a SPIA or a DIA, deferred income annuity, the insurance company forces you to look at that way because the $1 million that we were using, you know, that was the example from before, is gone, is now you have instead a promise of income. That's your benefit. There's no longer direct access to that $1 million lump sum. They've forced you to do it when you annuitize. Here, although they could treat it as a noun, they're essentially saying, no, I'm going to treat it like a verb. I'm all about the income. The $1 million is gone. Whether they eat away at it with fees or not is irrelevant to me because, you know, when you give money for a SPIA, the insurance company eats away at it by covering their costs and everything with that money that you gave them. So that kind of levels the playing field. So it's, they're choosing to treat it more like an annuitized annuity.
Exactly. And Chris, I'm going to attempt to do something on live recorded radio.
Uh-oh.
Yeah. I have no idea if this is how it works, but you know we use a very secure file service. We don't have to name who it is. Mm-hmm. But I also know I can share a link with you to get it. I have no idea how to do that. So I copied the link. I right-clicked and copied, and I pasted it in an email to you.
Okay.
And I think if you can log into the service, you should be able to pull up this document. Can you just tell me if you can get this document? Because you've got the calculator. I'm in Ohio with nothing. Mm-hmm. I'm actually, if you saw, I'm sitting on a lawn chair.
Yeah, I've got using the document in front of me.
But I'm sitting on a lawn chair using a box as my desk on a lawn chair. That's, and it's not even a real lawn chair. It's the kind you carry to like a outdoor event and you open it up, you unfold it and you sit on it. Yeah. That's all I have. I've got nothing. So.
Okay. No, I've got it. Yeah.
Because, so let me get back to this gentleman's email and the other email that I cannot find. The other email I cannot find, he took offense, not in an angry manner, but he thought I sounded a little too flippant on the approximately $341,000 that these people were going to pay on this annuity for the 10-year deferral period that it was going to be sitting there and about a 2 or 3 year payment period before their money would run out. And he couldn't understand why I called it a red herring and how I could support a product that, in his opinion, was taking too much money. And the reason is, and I thought I made this clear on the other podcast, when I look at this as an income source, because that's what I was told they're buying it for, if they shared with me, I'm nervous about the market, I want something safe for my money, I don't think I'm going to need the income, no, I would have been screaming blue murder, don't buy this annuity. But in defense of the insurance company, I feel they did not create this annuity for that purpose. And I would hope their compliance department or suitability department, they call it at the annuity realm, would have rejected the purchase of this annuity if the people would have listed that they don't want income and they're just looking for a safe place. They would have rejected it and said, hey, all our oomph on this annuity is going into this income benefit and you're paying dearly for it. Don't buy this. There are other annuities you could consider and that this company does have and others. So I would hope that that would have been the case. So that's why to that person and others who might feel the fees are high, and they are, if you might feel the fees are high, you have to look at what are these fees doing. And that's what I did. And I did it again today with Chris to walk people through it based on this email now that I do have. And this one, you already did the hint with the, Okay. Now, this gentleman says, I'm a longtime listener who loves your podcast. And Chris, I know he's a longtime listener. Guess how he spelled my name?
G-Y-M, I bet.
G-Y-M. Longtime listeners know that story. And it was, I don't want to get into it, folks, but we'll talk about it another time, or you might have heard it, how a rep from an insurance company spelled my name, G-Y-M. Okay. Jim, Chris, and J squared. So is that what we're calling Jacob and Jacob? Or Jake and Jacob? J squared?
Yeah, and if you're included, you're cubed, because there's J, J, and J.
Well, no, I'm Jim. I'm G-Y-M.
Oh, yeah, in this case, yeah, just J squared.
J squared. Okay. Huh. I don't think you're going to get this state hint. And let's get to it real quick so we can jump into this. My state has a number of state songs, but one is given for the state trivia challenge is called Rocky Top. And it's not what I came to my mind.
It's not.
Don't say Colorado, because that's what I thought. I was
no,
like, Colorado,
it's Tennessee. Seriously. Isn't it?
Say what?
It's Tennessee, isn't it?
How the hell did you know that?
I don't know. I pay attention to music. It's a song. It's a Dolly Parton song, isn't it?
You have no idea. I didn't think you were going to get this one because I thought Rockies, I think I'm Rocky Top. I thought Rockies, this must be Colorado. And it wasn't. It was Tennessee. All right. Here's the question. In your description about the living benefits, you were comparing buying a fixed income annuity with a living benefit now that will have a 10-year surrender period It's actually a 12-year surrender period, folks, but the people were going to turn... No, I apologize. It was a 10-year surrender period, and the people were going to turn the income on in 10 years. Mm-hmm. Okay. You compared it to buying a single premium immediate annuity a decade from now. Mm-hmm. While I concede that your process appropriately favors using a single premium immediate annuity only if additional assured income is needed, I do think your process complicates what could be an easier comparison for this person. What if they were to buy a fixed income annuity with the goal of turning on an income stream in a decade? So the simpler comparison is to show them buying a deferred income annuity today and turn it on in a decade. Mm-hmm. Chris, real quickly, because you're briefer than I am, mm-hmm. explain to people what a DIA, deferred income annuity, is, because we always talk about mm-hmm. SPIAs. Someone might be new wondering, what the hell's a DIA?
Yeah, so a deferred income annuity is a relationship with the insurance company that is pretty clean. You hand over a lump sum of money. Some allow you to put in money over time, I believe. Is that, Jim, is that correct? Or does it have to be a fixed index?
Correct. Most DIAs actually encourage you to invest over time.
So it doesn't have to be a lump sum, but oftentimes it is. You're putting in money. And this is kind of what this person, I think, is maybe proposing. It's you give some money during the deferral period over to the insurance company, knowing full well that that money's never coming back to you as a withdrawal, for instance. What you're going to get instead is an income promise that starts at a date in the future, which is usually predetermined, but has flexibility depending on the contract. So you've immediately annuitized is the key. You've created this verb. You've transformed your lump sum dollars, even if you've given it to them in several payments, into income benefit alone. You have no access as an account to draw from at that point. As opposed to a SPIA, single premium immediate annuity. Single premium simply means it is a single lump sum payment. Immediately means it starts within a year, technically 13 months from when you take out the contract. Longer periods of deferral than that, it becomes a DIA. So that's essentially the relationship with the insurance company. Nice and clean. No, it's pretty much a worm situation and a hook. It's, this is the income you're going to get. That's the worm. And so you bite the hook if you want to. No flashers, no fur, no spinning, none of that kind of extra stuff to try to attract you.
So he continues, this would have shown how much they need to pay for a given level of income in a decade, mm-hmm. and you could have compared it to the two products. For instance, what if they put $1 million into each? What would they receive in a decade? He goes on, and this is what I liked about it, because it ties into the other email that I can't find of the guy wondering how I could say 200. God, I wish I had the exact numbers. I'll have you figure them out in a second. It was 241,000, I think, up to 10 years, and then an additional 100 something after. But Chris will get the exact numbers, folks. And how I could so, I guess, flippantly say the 300 plus $1,000 fee of this annuity was a red herring. He writes, the high fees associated with that living benefit product and the surrender charge largely make it inadvisable for them to change their plan once started. So comparing it to a deferred income annuity seems a fair comparison. Mm-hmm. I love what he said there. Mm-hmm. And that is why, and I made it clear, I know I did on that discussion. The only reason I said the 340 something was a red herring and okay is I was looking at the product solely as an income stream. And we did do exactly what this person is asking for. Chris and I did it behind the scenes. So let me finish his last sentence and we'll get to replying. It is also a much easier comparison mm-hmm. looking at a DIA to this product because you will not have to speculate on what your assets might grow to in a decade in order to buy the single premium immediate annuity. Correct. He is correct there as well. But we did look at both, and I'm 99.9% certain I made mention of that on the show, maybe in passing, not as deep as I'm about to get into. Yeah. And why am I going to get into this? I told you guys and this listener and the other one who felt the fee was too high, do not get blindsided by the ability to actually figure out the fee of these products. They don't make it clear, and you have to divine it, which is unfortunate. The regulators should make them put in dollars what you're going to pay. And I tried to explain to you guys how you can go about divining what the fee is. To me, the fee on a fixed indexed annuity is crucial if you don't want the income or if there's a chance you don't want the income. And I did tell this person I was working with specifically, not in that verbiage, but that if they did not turn this income benefit on, this was not an appropriate purchase. And you could walk away with very little growth at all over that decade because such a large percentage is coming out to pay for an income benefit that you then don't use. And that a lot of these products will not grow during the deferral phase at the same level that they would grow at the same level that they would grow on annuities that don't come with these very expensive income riders. The reason I don't want you guys to become blindsided like the other emailer was, or as your inherent warning signs against fees would keep you from recommending this product, is sometimes these annuities pay more than a deferred income annuity, as you'll see in a minute, or a single premium immediate annuity might pay. This gentleman is right. We can compare an apple to an orange here. An apple to an apple, and we're going to do that in a second. We were predominantly comparing an apple to an orange. This particular withdrawal benefit and annuity that the person was going to turn on in 10 years, and we were trying to compare it to buying a single premium immediate annuity in 10 years. Because we as a firm, and personally between Chris and I, we favor people keeping their money liquid and available and non-committed to an insurance company until they're certain they need it. But when we do meet people who are adamant they want the income, and this couple was adamant they want the income and they want it in 10 years, we have to instead look at these products and compare them. Mm-hmm. And we did. So let's get to what we did. First thing, we compared it to a SPIA.
Well, let's first, just to tighten things up for people who maybe didn't follow the whole story, what they came to us with was an annuity they were considering putting $1 million into, and then in 10 years, turning on the income benefit, technically a withdrawal benefit, but start receiving income from this that would have been $173,000 every year for the rest of their lives. That was the original, and it was under in a structure of a fixed indexed annuity with a guaranteed with minimum withdrawal benefit rider attached to it. That was the format in which that relationship came to us with this policy. We then compared that to waiting 10 years and buying a SPIA, which is where Jim was headed. So you can take it from there if you want.
And that's a typical calculation we do, because what we want to see, and this gentleman is right, there is a I don't want to say a bit, there's quite a bit of unknown over this coming decade, both for this couple who are adamant today in 2025 they want the income, who knows, 2027, 2030, 2032, 2034 and a half, maybe they don't need the income anymore. So there's always that risk. But with the calculation that we're about to walk you through, there's always the risk that in 10 years, mortality tables change and become less beneficial because people are living longer. Most insurance companies will update mortality tables every decade or so. So you do run into the issue that maybe the mortality tables change, which simply means you would have to put a little bit more money in 10 years from now. If people are living longer, they're going to be a little less generous if they change the mortality table. But also interest rates can change. And interest rates in 10 years could be lower than they are today. Conversely, which would mean if they are lower than they are today, the person may have to put more money in than we're estimating. But conversely, if interest rates are higher 10 years from today, or significantly higher even 10 years from today, they may only have to put in 80% of what we estimated they would have to put in. There is that degree of unknown with this first analysis that we did do, and we want to walk you through it so you can do this for people. You're at the forefront of this. You're going to come across people contemplating buying these products, and they're going to be asking you, what do you think I should do? Don't just fix it. I know you guys. You guys are going to run. You're going to go, oh, let me find that page that Jim said in the illustration. And with that page, I can figure out what the fees are. And then you're going to fixate on those fees and go, oh my God, this isn't worth it. Look at these fees. No. You would fixate and say it's not worth it. Look at these fees. If the person you're trying to help says, gee, I don't know if I really want the income benefit. That's not important to me. I'm just looking for a safe place for my money. Then yes, look at the fees. But if they're telling you, oh no, George, I definitely want this money. I don't want to deal with the uncertainty today, or I'm trying to help my spouse, my husband, or my wife in case I die. I'm trying to keep things simple. If they share something like that, that they're adamant they want it, you can show them the fee, but please put the fee in context. Okay. So what we wanted to do, or what we always do, is say, hey, what if this couple didn't put the $1 million in this annuity? What if they instead put it in an investment account, which is what we favor? We personally favor not, quote unquote, annuitizing right away. Although in this particular case, there's always exceptions. I supported what this couple was looking to do based on everything they shared with me. They hired us for our opinion. They're not our client. So anyways, what we normally would do, or what we did do, is we said, hey, what would, in 10 years, how old will these people be? The wife will be 78, the husband will be 81. That's the oldest they'll be. They'll be, in the year they turn 78, they're going to be 78. So in 10 years, they're going to be 78 and 81. What would today a 78 and 81-year-old need to put into a single premium immediate annuity to get joint and survivor $173,000 for the rest of their life, no cost of living increase because the living premium benefit rider had a snowball's chance in hell of getting a cost of living increase, but we did want to try to keep this fair. One of the hooks on that lore called the living benefit rider is the ability to say to someone, and if you don't want the income, you can call the deal off and take your money out. So because this annuity does have that feature, and they're not going to get all their money back because the fees are very, very high in this annuity, but the ability to get some money out if they call the deal off is appealing, we restricted our quotes to joint life, but 10-year period certain. So Chris will explain all of this in a second. What we then do is say, okay, this is how much the annuity would cost someone today. We recognize 10 years from now, mortality tables could change or interest rates could change. But it gives us a starting point. And it lets us then say, if we put $1 million in an investment, what would it have to earn every year to grow to what we need today to give us this income of $173,000 a year for 10 years minimum, or life, whatever is longer. So I think I explained that fairly good, Chris. Walk people through the numbers you found and the embedded internal rate of return.
Yeah. So for a 81 and 78-year-old, joint and survivor, $173,000 a year, at today's interest rates and mortality tables, the cost for a SPIA that would pay that would be right about $2 million. $2 million from an A++ rated insurance company, about $1,925,000 from the same company that was quoting this original annuity to these people. So that would be the closest apples to apples comparison. And so then we look at that and say, well, gee, what would, if you had $1 million today, right? And instead of putting into that other contract, you held on to it for 10 years before you SPIA-tized it, is what we call it, buying the SPIA, how much growth would you have to see? What rate of return would you have to average on that million? So you'd end up with the $1,925,000 to buy an equivalent SPIA that would behave like this original annuity with the guaranteed with minimum withdrawal benefit. And it turns out 6.77% is the rate, which, being able to be assured of that rate over a 10-year period, may or may not be reasonable, depending on what happens over that 10-year period. So that is, you're facing some investment risk, right? You might not achieve those returns and end up with the $1,925,000 or close to $2 million. You might end up with more, but the nice thing is you, during that whole time, you haven't committed to an insurance company. It's, you've got full flexibility on what you do with those dollars, and you could change your mind without anything, that, you know, a penalty or any other restrictions, because you haven't actually engaged with the insurance company yet. But that would be the rate of return one would need to earn in order to kind of have the comparison work out here using the same starting $1 million.
Right. And did you talk about the other company that wanted $2 million, the next one? Or
yeah,
you just
that,
talked
that,
about
yeah, no, that one was the A++ rated company, so slightly better rated insurance company, but A+ is the company in question, and the $1,925,000 quote was from the same company that the original fixed indexed annuity was from. So that's the closest apples to apples comparison there.
Right, and that's what we found interesting. At $2 million, you would have to have earned about 7.3-ish, about, Chris?
7.2. To double your money in 10 years at 7.2%. Rule of 72, remember?
Right. But the annuity company that was offering this fixed indexed annuity with the living benefit rider also came back with a quote, and they're an A-plus rated company, not A++, of 1.925. So it gave us the ability to get a fairly good assessment of what, at minimum, someone should strive to earn over the next decade. Now, we have seen situations where the growth rate over the deferral time could easily be achieved in a multi-year guaranteed annuity matched to the amount of deferral time. Yeah. And that changes the math a lot, because now you're all but assured that you're going to have the minimum amount of income you might need. But as this gentleman did say in his email, there's always that bit of uncertainty. So he said, why didn't you guys compare it to a deferred income annuity?
Right.
We did, and I thought, I didn't get into it deeply on the podcast, but I thought I mentioned it briefly.
Yeah, and the benefits there is you now have put on your risk of earning that 6.77%. You've pushed that investment risk onto the insurance company, because they're making you the income promise right up front, and they're the ones who have to make sure the money grows to be able to deliver that to you, and they're promising or guaranteeing to you that that's going to happen. So he's right that you would sidestep that, but as we've already described with deferred income annuities, you've immediately annuitized, so you've given up that 10 years of calling it off and just taking the money and doing something else with it or what have you. But he is right. You would then avoid the burden of earning the rate of return needed to by the SPIA down the road.
Okay. One thing, Chris, on live recorded radio, do you have the ability, because when we did this deferred income annuity quote, which we're going to walk people through in a second, did you put 10-year period certain?
I did.
Okay, perfect.
To keep it equal.
Excellent. So here's the next thing we wanted to do, and we did do this prior to chatting with this person and prior to the EDU show, and I thought I made mention of it. Our approach that we just described at 6.77, many of you are sitting there thinking, oh, no problem. My portfolio over the last decade has blown by that. You know, you should definitely invest the money and then buy the income if you need it. That's fine. That's up to a person to decide. It's not up to us to decide. We let a person decide that. I would favor, if it was in the fours, maybe even the fives, I might be a little more receptive to it. But when someone is so adamant they want the income, I tend to think they must be very conservative investors. I don't know if they could handle the volatility that might be needed for a 6.77 expected rate of return or required rate of return or even a 5 required rate of return for a decade. You can't get a multi-year guaranteed annuity paying you 5 for a decade. You can get them paying to you a 5 for 3 years, maybe 5 years, but not a decade. So there just seems to be some risk. So the other option is to say, well, wait a minute. What if we were to simply get a deferred income annuity, a VERB, where the money goes in and I lose access to it? Because with this product, as this emailer rightly pointed out, with the very high fees, you're essentially locking your money in and not taking it out because you're going to lose the income benefit. You would think, folks, putting money into a deferred income annuity where the insurance company knows you can't back out would cost less than putting $1 million into this annuity where you can still back out. Granted, for the first 10 years, you got a penalty period. What did we find, Chris? What did we find that if somebody who is 68 and 71 today, female 68, male 71 today, how much would they have to put in today to get $173,000 beginning in 10 years for the rest of their lives, joint and survivor, no cost of living increase for as long as they live with a 10-year minimum payout? So if they died within the first year, 9 more years of payments would continue to their beneficiaries. They wouldn't clearly get all of their money back. But the fact is, neither will the person buying the fixed indexed annuity because of the fees. You're never going to get your full $1 million back either because the insurance company has taken out fees. But Chris, what did we find a DIA would cost?
So a DIA to generate that same $173,000 in 10 years, today you'd have to put in $1.2 million, a full 20% more than you would put into this original fixed indexed annuity with the guaranteed minimum withdrawal benefit.
So, and is that with the same insurance company or a different one?
It was, I believe, with the same insurance company. If not, it was at the same rating of insurance company.
Okay.
Oh, so I take it back. No, remember, this company didn't offer a DIA because they're pushing these fixed indexed annuities.
Right. That's right.
So they didn't even offer it. But it was a similar insurance company. Wanted $1.2 million in a deferred income annuity to do it. And remember, you've now made the commitment to only take income right at the beginning, other than your beneficiaries, you know, could be paid 10 years of those payments, which would be $130,000 over 10 years. So you're getting more than your 1.2 out. But remember, that 1.2, had you kept it over the 10 years before you turned on the income, hopefully should have grown reasonably. So you got to factor that in as well. But we wanted to make it similar to that fixed indexed annuity original, in that the, you know, at minimum you were going to get your, your money back, which would create payments for a certain period of time. If you were to die a little early, your beneficiaries would get something, which might be of interest to certain people. They're not okay with just purely an income promise. And this deferred income annuity had a similar feature in that at least you'd get payments for 10 years, no matter whether you were alive or dead.
So now you see why, for those who thought I might have been a little too flippant on the fee, why I still said I had to support it.
Yeah.
I can't tell someone, no, you don't want to put $1 million into that product with an A-plus rated insurance carrier. Granted, I think their income benefit rider is too flashy, too confusing. They're going to give you for $1 million what it would cost in a DIA, deferred income annuity, $1.2 million. That's silly. That's why I said it was a red herring, the fee, and I might have sounded a little flippant. But as for this gentleman who sent this email, now you see why we did do the calculation, but we didn't build it into our recommendation, because I'm not going to recommend someone put $1.2 million into a product. It wasn't even worth bringing up in the extent of, I don't see them turning around and saying, well, I'll go with the $1.2 million one. That one sounds good. I give up access and control to my money. I put 20% more in and I'll get the same amount of income. I'll take that one. I don't see somebody saying that. So you guys, because y'all are geek out on this stuff, you're investment experts. You're sitting there saying, how the hell can they do that? How can they give more with less? The answer is staring you right in the face. Let's go to that document I sent you, Chris.
I've got it.
Perfect. I don't have mine up. Hold on. Okay, now I got it. This is what Chris is looking at, and you guys can find, if you ever help somebody with one of these living benefit riders, there will always be a contractual minimum page. And because these are predominantly written on the backs of fixed indexed annuities, although RILAs, registered index linked annuities, they're growing in popularity, but for now, they're pretty much written on the backs of fixed indexed annuities. They used to be written on the backs of variable annuities, but not so much anymore. They, being the insurance company, has to show the guaranteed side. That's a rule. Well, the guaranteed side is the way of saying worst case scenario. The worst case scenario, folks, is you don't earn anything for the 10-year deferral period. Is that going to happen? No. You know the annuity will earn something. Maybe not every year. These are fixed indexed annuities. So if they were indexed, say, to the S&P, I don't know what they're going to index to. If they were indexed to the S&P and there were a couple of negative years over that 10-year period, they would receive zero. Remember, zero is your hero in the fixed indexed annuity world. That's another sales pitch. Another one of those flashy little lures that they're going to say zero is your hero. So the insurance company has to have this zero page on. You see, Chris, where it says contract value. And then you see surrender value.
Yes.
Notice that they both don't equal. That makes sense, correct?
It does make sense because of the penalty period.
Perfect.
Yep.
That's all we need to know. Penalty period.
So, for instance, right on day one, there's a 10% penalty that first year. So the contract value, you put in your million, nothing's happened yet, so it's still a million. But the surrender value is only 900,000. They're going to charge you 10% kind of early withdrawal penalty, we'll call it a surrender penalty in that first year. So that's what we're talking about. There's a difference between those two.
Okay. So the contract value is what your annuity has earned. The surrender value is where the fee, the early withdrawal fee is shown. I'm not looking at the surrender value, and neither should you. This person's not surrendering it.
No, they're keeping it for at least 10 years. Yeah.
That's what they're hoping. So we look at contract value.
Yep.
Zero is your hero, Chris. So contract value should be $1 million all the way down for 10 years, right?
Well, that's what you'd, you know, sound like, oh, you earn zero. You can never, quote, lose is how they describe this. You can never lose due to index performance, but the contract value in at the end of the first year is $984,857. It's down essentially $15,000 from where it was. How could that be? You've, quote, lost. Well, because of the fees.
$15,000 for 10 years. Yep. Okay, so $150,000 at the 10 years. So there should be about $850,000 in year 10. Mm-hmm. What's the contract value in year 10, Chris?
It is $764,000, almost $100,000 below where you might expect it to be.
What the hell's going on there, folks?
The fees
How
going
can
up.
That be?
Yeah.
Well, what is happening, and keep this in mind as you help people with this, if you want to help them figure out the fees, especially if they're not buying the income benefit. The step that I'm doing now is a red herring as far as the person I tried helping. I tried showing them that, look, if you go with a single premium immediate annuity, put the money aside, you got to earn more than 6.77. I don't work with them, so I don't know if that's within their risk tolerance level, but that would be a fairly aggressive portfolio. And I certainly couldn't recommend a DIA at 20% more income. I actually like this product as a withdrawal product. If somebody is looking today to guarantee a certain amount of income 10 years from now, and they're willing to give up that flexibility. Now, you might be sitting there, though, and saying, but Jim, they can get out of this annuity at any time. True, but they do have to pay a penalty if they, quote unquote, get out at any time. But even if they wait the 10 years and the penalty goes away, they're going to give up a good chunk of their change to the insurance company in fees. Chris, how much did they pay in fees? Just subtract the $1 million from the year 10 value and we go from there.
$235,620.
Okay, why did that go up more? If the first year fee was 15 grand, why is it nearly $100,000 more than what you thought it would be at the end of 10 years? Well, because the benefit rider, and this is key on how this insurance company can do this, the benefit rider fee of 1.1% is not based on the $1 million this person put in. This is based on the pretend account, which this particular annuity, if you go back and listen to the podcast from a couple of weeks ago, the EDU show, guarantee it to grow. The pretend account will grow at 9.5% compounding for 12 years or until you turn income on. They were going to turn income on in 10 years. Chris, you can see that it's called the income benefit base.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
You can clearly see it growing quite rapidly, is it not?
At 9.5%, yeah.
So,
and there's a bonus. There must be a bonus because the benefit base right at the beginning
is a 30% bonus.
$1.3 million. So there's a 30% bonus and then 9.5%. Is that what's going on here?
Correct.
Yeah. Sounds, boy, there's the flashy lure.
Oh my God, isn't it? You get 30% again on the income benefit base. So your $1 million is now worth $1.3 million, and we're going to grow it at 9.5% compounding. Oh God, this sounds too good to be true. And for an income product, it is pretty damn good. I'll give them that. It's just way too complicated. If this is what they're willing to pay, they should have just said, look, we're willing to pay this, and here's what we're going to charge you for it. But they can't. They had to somehow bury what you're going to see in a minute to be a $300,000+ fee. They wouldn't sell this if they were going to tell people, we're going to charge you $340,000+ to have this income benefit. No one would buy it. But if you bury it in all this flash, it looks pretty good. Okay. So if you then look at year 11, Chris, but you start to see this account runs out pretty darn fast.
Yep.
even though they're only taking 173,000 out and they have 764,000 as an account balance. This is no growth. This is the worst case scenario. This is how you can determine the fee. That 764 runs out a little bit quicker than you would think, Chris. It runs out in 3 years.
Correct.
Because what's happening is the 173,000 is coming out for 3 years as well, Chris. So go 173 times three minus that balance. I can't see it. The 555, whatever.
936.
Actually, you would subtract it from the 764,380.
Right.
So go 173 times 3 minus 764,380. What does that come to?
245 and some change. $245,000.
Is the 173? Oh, it's left
difference.
Over.
Yep.
Okay. Now add, because that's what I just showed, is that's the remaining fee. Mm-hmm. For the last 3 years of this annuity was how much, Chris?
$245,000.
And what was the fee at the beginning?
$15,000 per year.
Oh, $15,000. It goes up every year, remember?
Yeah. Yep. So that fee, the key is it's based on the benefit base number. Which right. goes up and up at that, you know, got the 30% bonus, then you've got the 9.5% growth. And then as you use the money, the benefit base doesn't go down. Only your contract value goes down. So, you know, that fee stays at the peak until the account is drained. And then you're just getting the income. Then you're just getting the income after that. So it doesn't take very long before you, after you turn on the income, that there's nothing left for beneficiaries anyway. And I would argue that having a 10-year period certain on your DIA or your SPIA is going to give you more money, you know, a guarantee of more money back than this would, given the 0% growth rate, right? Which is worst case scenario. So if you got more than that, then you've got a little different story going on here. But the nice thing about the DIA and the SPIA, all the parts of those are guaranteed by the insurance company. There's not the what if, hopefully, maybe any of those kind of words going on.
Okay, I'm just doing a calculation here.
Okay,
so for the first 10 years, the total fee, folks, is $235,620. Let's just call it $235,000. Mm-hmm. That's the fee for the first 10 years. And again, you can find that by looking on this page with the zero growth and just look at how the account balance drops. And that takes you right to the year 10. Then it drops quite precipitously mm-hmm. to 555, 347, 139, and zero.
Yeah. So that fee in year 11 is that's what you're trying to get to. That's right. Going to be over $35,000.
$35,000 a year is what
per year.
Good, because that's what I figured out when you were a little hesitant. I was like, wait a minute. $35,000 a year for the next 3 years is the fee.
Yep.
Because the fee, folks, is always 1.1% of the pretend account.
Yep. And that pretend account has gotten artificially huge, right? Because of that the 30% bonus and then the 9.5% growth rate. So yes, they've made this income promise, but of course the percentage of payout is very small on that huge benefit base. But the kicker is they're charging the fee based on the benefit base. So that's how they make money by making the benefit base grow so fast on the left hand side. They are increasing the fee more than you'd imagine it to be because you're thinking of 1.1%. How innocent. $35,000 a year in those final years. So between that and the $173,000 they're handing you every year, it drains the remaining balance within the 3 year period there. Again, assuming 0% growth on any of this, and it's just being affected by all the fees and the distributions that happen once you turn on the withdrawal benefit.
And they will get some growth, folks, but it'll be in the low single digits. Trust me, low single digits. I'm trying to drive home the point, though, as we wrap up. Mm-hmm. How can they do this? How can the insurance company want 1.2 million in a deal? The same company want 1.2 million. Excuse me, not 1.2 million. The same company. There was a different company. The same company doesn't even sell a deal. But how could another insurance company want 1.2 million to give the same income benefit that another company asking for 1 million and also claiming on their little lore, this money is yours. You don't, it's a noun. It's not a verb. You buy that deal, you can't get your money out. In this product, you can get your money out. The reason is just by doing these calculations that you can walk through on that particular page of the illustration showing zero growth, you can see, Chris, clearly the insurance company is going to get $340,000 from these people. Clearly, the DIA is not getting $340,000. They're getting significantly, significantly, significantly less. And you can't just say, well, if the DIA wants 1.2 million and this is getting 340,000 fee, the DIA must be charging a $140,000 fee. Not even close. You can't do it that way. The reason these insurance companies can sometimes beat an annuitized SPIA or DIA is human nature.
Yeah.
And these fees.
It's almost like a mortality credit. Not only is there mortality credits in annuities, here you've got behavioral credits. Because I know where you're going with this. To the people who remain. And that's what's happening. That's what makes that $200,000 differential there, where you're only putting $1 million in here, is because they know the vast majority of people are going to walk away from the income promise. And they'll have collected their fees for something the person never benefits from. They know how many on average that happens to, just like they know on average how many people die in an annuity pool. So when they make the income promise to you, in this case, the withdrawal benefit promise, they're doing it based on the assumption that X number of people are going to walk away and we can make the lure shinier for those, you know, for people, because we know a lot of people are going to take the hook and then walk. Instead of getting why it hooked them in the first place. So in the DIA, there's none of those flashy things going on. There's none of those games going on. So they just have to price it straight up.
And I cannot remember where I read this, and I'm not going to be able to find it, but it was recent. And it was somebody talking about how many annuities are actually, withdrawal benefit annuities, actually lapse. Never have the income benefit turned on, and it's over 60%.
Yep.
People buy them, pay these outrageous fees, and walk away. So Chris hit the nail on the head. In a traditional annuitized annuity, you have mortality credits. In these products, you have behavioral or ignorance credit.
Mm-hmm. On top of the mortality credits that already are there as well. So it's an extra bonus.
So the insurance company knows there's going to be, or feel, they don't know for certain. It's just that history has proven to them the majority of these will never be turned on for one reason or another. But in the meantime, the insurance company took $340,000 from these people. Now, not necessarily the people I'm chatting about. Hopefully they turn it on in 10 years. Hopefully they live long enough. It's going to take a lot longer. This account's going to hit zero, maybe not in the 3 years that's on the worst case illustration, but it most likely will hit zero in 5 to 7 years after turning it on, because there's not going to be much growth. And we know for certain $340,000 of fees will come out over that 13-year period. before the account balance technically reaches zero. Now, there could be more. If there is a little bit of growth in this annuity, and I assume there would be, there'll be an additional $35,000 a year coming out. Keep that in mind, folks. This is showing the worst case scenario. There's going to be an additional $35,000 a year. Does that make sense, Chris?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So there you have it, folks, in a nutshell, how insurance companies can do this.
Yep.
They're getting an outrageous amount of fees. And again, it's a red herring, in my opinion. And this email listener was correct. Not the one who took offense, not personally, but thought I was too flippant on $300,000+. But this gentleman who says, well, wait a minute, just compare it to a DIA, because essentially, as he wrote, the people, when they buy this, they're not going to take the money out. Hopefully, they're buying it for the income, and the money is locked in there.
That enforces proper behavior, I guess, with the DIA, because it forces you to take the income. I guess that's one good thing about it. But you had to put more money into it. The people who pay the price on the fees are those who walk and never benefit from the income that they bought in the first place.
So can you argue that this is a high fee? I don't know. It's for those who turn the income on and, of course, live long enough, it was worth it. Yeah. But everyone else pays for it. Right. Those who walk away and those who die too soon. Okay.
Perfect.
So hopefully that cleared the air a little. I found this interesting.
Hopefully. We had to go marathon long on the show here. We're at an hour and 56 minutes at this point. So
That's marathon.
Yeah.
But hopefully, folks, you found it interesting. I know some of you guys geek out on this and you like to crunch these numbers, but you're also wondering how can they, Jim, say $340,000 is not a big fee? And now you know why. And how can these insurance companies do it? If a DIA wants $1.2 million, how can they do it at 20% less premium? The DIA is pure insurance, and they want $1.2 million. Mm-hmm. How can they do it for 20% less?
Smoke and mirrors. There you go.
Yep. All right. There you go.
Yeah. So thanks, everybody, for listening. More questions come up, let us know. If you want to send your own questions, send them to Jim directly. Jim@jimhelps.com is the email address. Put in the subject line that it's a question for the podcast and include a couple words about the topic. That's appreciated. And we'll do our best to get you an answer addressed on the show here. If we don't answer your specific question, I'm pretty sure we'll answer a question substantially similar to yours. So we appreciate you not only sending in your questions, but also listening to all the answers that we put forth on the show. And that's it. Jim, you take care. Everybody else, stay safe. And we'll be back with you next week with a brand new show.
You have listened to Jim on the radio, read his quotes in the media, and enjoyed his banter on iTunes. But even now, you may wonder what sets Jim Saulnier and Associates apart from other financial planning companies. The answer is quite simple. Jim's diverse team of professionals specializes in retirement planning. They form a lifelong relationship with you and measure their success not through product sales, but through the security and prosperity you may achieve in your retirement. Jim's entire team shares his unwavering commitment to placing their clients' best interests first while offering their services at fair prices with full disclosures. The professionals at Jim Saulnier & Associates are available to assist you with your retirement planning needs. Visit jimhelps.com to schedule your complimentary coffee and a second opinion meeting. That's Jim, HELPS.com. Or call 970-530-0556.
The Retirement and IRA Show represents the words and views of the show hosts exclusively and should not be construed as investment, legal, or tax advice. All information is believed to be from reliable sources. However, we make no representation as to its completeness or accuracy. All economic and performance information is historical in nature and is not indicative of any future results. Any indices mentioned on the show are unmanaged and cannot be invested in directly. Diversification and asset allocation strategies do not assure profit or protect against loss. Never make any investment or financial decisions based on information offered on this show without first consulting your financial, legal, or tax advisor. Financial planning services offered through Jim Saulnier & Associates, LLC, a registered investment advisor.